You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
In a red flag scenario where you're fighting a bunch of fourth gen and even some legacy fifth gen, no offense.
It's so rude because it is a nice webcam. Ender's got the he's got the headphones now. It's really official.
Move. So does it track your face? Is that what?
No. I don't have the Rain set up. I have the
I have the fifth gen webcam. That's the only thing I have I can claim to fame. But gents, I think the intro here belongs to Vader on this one, even though we got kind of rolling. So Vader, it's over to you there.
All right. Well, hey, everybody, and welcome to another Bro Chat with Rain, the true host of this one, and myself, Vader, and then we've got Bender, and today we have Billy Flynn, who's rejoining Rain, but joining Bender and I for the first time. So, hey, thanks, everybody, for being here, and as Bender did previously, we'll thank Rain's Patreon supporters. Cause that was a
when do we Billy, thanks for being some here. Of that,
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yes. Just kick your way. I think Billy, you're treading dangerously close to becoming a co-host on the Afterburn podcast.
Look, I listen to you three guys go on every one of these bro chats, and it's remarkably amusing.
Maybe a good way.
So I'm happy to be allowed to join you for a day and to chat.
Well, thanks for taking the time. It's been a little bit of a scheduling juggle as everyone's, you know, the holiday season, traveling around. Vader is, again, stepping back in time into the Eagle and all that stuff. So we can hear about that today. But I wanted to kick it off some Patreon questions. I think this would be a good one. And it's awesome to have Billy on here because he's much smarter than the three of us. And this might be a great one for you. So fence in, Billy. He goes, what do the bros think of John Boyd's philosophy, especially his focus on reforming defense acquisition to win the next war? Who's the 21st century John Boyd? Will acquisition become a barrier to effective sixth-gen acquisition and force modernization? How do we keep the acquisition from getting in the way of constraining operators' ability to employ weapons that will win the next war? That's a lot there to unpack, but I think we all can attest we have felt the struggles of the acquisition process when it comes to getting the new things or the most effective items to go out there and fight and just do the job from day in and day out, as we usually gripe about how terrible the IT system is, for instance. But Billy, what do you think? I'll throw the little ticker tape there on the bottom of the video. Yeah, it might be more distracting than anything.
Oh, there you go. There's no easy answer, right? We all collectively in our time flying have seen programs get fielded quicker than others, and some that we really wanted to field in big numbers never happened. Look at it, Raptors, right? 700 something in the beginning, then whatever it was, 380, and now ultimately 189, and really not all of them are combat coded. F-35, we all lived it. The topic and the theme of concurrency, trying to field jets right away as you're developing them, so you get them out in the field and you start learning about the jet early on, and then hopefully mature the technologies as time goes on, as the operators get more familiar with the airplanes. There's better ways to fund it. Is it a fixed price contract and you force the contractor to fit in the boundaries of a contract, or is it cost plus, so the contractor gets paid for all the changes along the way? the analogy that I use, because I hear it in my house, because we do lots of renovations, I explain to my wife that program creep is exactly what happens when you bring a contractor in to work on your house. When they come in the beginning, they'll give you an estimate and they'll go, hey, look, it'll take me 4 weeks and it's cost this amount of money to redo your kitchen. And sure enough, they start, and then someone in the household goes, hey, I want you to put a wall here, and I need you to put some cabinets here, and I need this other electrical outlet put here. And all of a sudden, you're a week later, and it's going to cost that much more. And then 2 weeks in, the same thing happens, sort of thing happens again. And, you know, it's taking you twice as long and twice as much money. And that actually happens a lot with development programs. They start with a great idea, and somewhere along the line, stuff gets added on. Time goes on, and all of a sudden you're way late and you're way over budget. I don't think there's any answer. And I read lots about people that have great ideas. Will Roper, who when he retired, talked about basically century series, putting out airplanes quickly and in rapid succession without the long development lines. I don't think you're going to find any perfect answer. There are some programs that do well. Go to Phantom Works in Boeing. Go to Skunk Works and give them a project to do. Get out of their way, like the great Kelly Johnson used to preach, and let them do their thing, and they won't get mired in the government bureaucracy, and they'll come up with a product perhaps better than you imagined. But that's not always the perfect way to develop stuff either, because neither of those organizations are production organizations. They're really prototyping organizations. So, you know, is there a way to do this better? Probably not. Last thing I'll say, though, is you need to stay the course. So everyone blames Secretary Gates for canceling the Raptor, but there's a lot of people behind Gates that fed him information that ultimately led to that decision, including guys in uniform, guys and gals in uniform, blue suiters, right? Air Force people contributed to ultimately the decision to cancel the Raptor. You need to stay the course in the long game, and that in today's age, that's you need to stick with F-35 and F-35 for year upon year upon year. And when other stakeholders come in because time's moved on, they have different agendas. They're from the state of Washington and they love Boeing and they don't like Lockheed Martin. And they just happily hammer F-35 and cancel it. So you really have to have the long game in mind. And if there had been a long game, there'd be 120 B-2s and there'd be 380 Raptors out there, and we wouldn't be in the sorry state we are in now. Does that help as an intro?
I think it does. I'm curious, the simpleton mind of my mind, like, can we talk KC-46 and like that acquisition process? Because it sounds like the news is like Boeing's getting hammered, because that is a cost plus, correct, contract? Or what is that in comparison to what we're talking about with like the F-35? Or can you compare those two?
Well, you guys have said it. It's a 767 tanker.
It's been around for a while.
This isn't a clean sheet airplane. There is no part of this that Boeing gets off the hook for. And we as the operators have to wait for Boeing to sort this out. Well, we have KC-135s and KC-10s out there, this incredibly old tanker fleet that really have a strategic imperative for us, right? We need the tankers. And now we're waiting for a rejuvenated 767? Seriously, how does that happen?
That's a great question. I don't think Boeing's going to sponsor the podcast, but yeah, I mean, it is something like, so like, it is a 767 that's been around. Like, how do we get to this point 20 years later, where if we peel back the onion, what can we point the finger at? 10 things, one thing, five things?
No, you could have pointed a thing at a program office and the customer hammering them from the beginning. Absolutely. We have a responsibility as the people buying them to have put their feet to the fire early on and not allowed that to happen.
We here at the Kodiak Shack podcast would like to welcome our new sponsor, Adamus Cyber. Working with the military means there are some minimum cybersecurity requirements that are in every contract. Complying with these requirements can be painfully slow and really take your company's focus off your military customers and end users. Thankfully, the team at Adamus has simplified the process exclusively for small businesses working with the military. It should be expected that security requirements are going to be a part of working with the military, but they don't have to be difficult. Learn why prior guests on the podcast like Arun from OpsLab or Brian from ResCon use Atomos to comply with the NIST 800-171, DFARS 7012, and CMMC cybersecurity requirements in their contracts. Check out their website at www.atomoscyber.com and tell them you heard about them from the Kodiak Shack podcast. Their website will be in the show notes. We appreciate all the companies that want to work with the military, and we understand working with the government isn't always the easiest thing, but we appreciate companies like Atomos that make it just a little bit easier.
Because initially, the contract was awarded to Airbus, right, initially, and then some lawsuits happened and we backtracked. So that, I don't know, I think that backed it up another 10 years or so. So, I mean, it's unfortunate that we don't have that capability now. Just like you're saying, I think at the end of that question, he says, you know, how do we avoid the fight? I think he mentions China, but in the future, and I think you nailed it, Billy, like that could have been avoided in 2008 or nine when they decided to cancel the Raptors. If we had 700 Raptors, I don't think we'd be talking about, you know, the Taiwan Straits the way we're talking about them today. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, I think you really have to, I mean, you peel back the onion and ultimately like the way our defense industrial complex is built with Washington. Here, random term limits. If we threw term limits in, we might solve a lot of these problems. But, you know, the fact that they get a vote over and over again in the way, or not they get a vote, but everyone gets a vote. But you are getting reelected. You need money to get reelected. The only way you're going to get reelected is usually by having big companies support you and doing the, I don't know. This gets to be a very complex problem set. I think now you can't undo and go back to the way it was to move this forward any faster. I don't know.
Look, here's what we do need. We need two engine manufacturers. We don't want a monopoly on that. We need multiple airframe manufacturers. So we have really three now, right? Northrop Grumman's back in the game. We don't want to be like in Italy or Spain or BAE in England, which has a stranglehold on everything, or in Germany. It's now Airbus Defense, but mixed with France. But we don't ever want that. And if we have to throw contracts to Boeing with T-7 to keep a lifeline so 17,000 people can come to work in St. Louis and be gainfully employed because the Hornet line is dying and F-15EX wasn't really going yet, then we do have to do that. Like at some point, we're going to have to throw a lifeline for engines at GE because Pratt has pretty much had a monopoly. And oh, by the way, they've had a stranglehold on contracts for F-35 and those negotiations all along the way, knowing that they were the sole engine manufacturer. We have to keep spreading the wealth in that sense, because if we don't, then we really run the risk of not having the capacity to be able to arm ourselves and build the fleets that we are going to need as a nation, as the warring nation in the world.
I just have a random question. How hard would it be to bring the F-22 line back on? I mean, I know that's not going to happen, pretty much impossible. No. They talk about how heavy of a lift that is, but how heavy of a lift is it actually?
I think it's all been dismantled in that other side of Marietta across the field from where the C-130s are built. Everything's gone and it's outdated, right? When was the last Raptor? I was around when we were chasing it, but that's a long time ago. And a lot of that technology is so old compared to what we've learned. Look at an F-35 production line when you get a chance, if you haven't, to go to Fort Worth. That's world-class production. And Raptor was never really at that level. Anything as sophisticated as that, I don't think you can bring it back.
I think one of the things about it is, I mean, I don't think anybody argues that anything can maneuver much better, if not equal to the Raptor, you know. So we have this platform that is wildly capable and maneuverable and everything. And maybe we don't need that. Maybe it's just exciting to see it. But, you know, I think a lot of people, the 35 has tons of capes, but then you see the Raptor do what it does and you're like, that's impressive. Like it's hard not to be impressed, you know.
It's magic.
Yeah.
I'm an F-35 air show guy and I watched the Raptor demo this summer and I just, it's just so eye-watering. It's It's such a level up beyond anything an F-35 could do. It really is astonishing. Yeah.
One day. All right, switching gears here a little bit. This one was directed at Bender, but I think, Billy, you probably can jump in on the last half of this. And it says, Bender, are you flying F-35s full-time, part-time? On average, how many sorties a month do you fly? Is that enough? Do you feel it's enough to be proficient? And what is the most fun training mission in F-35?
So I fly full-time. So I'm an activated reservist. AGR is what they call it. For me, at least to stay combat mission ready, I have to fly, I think, 6 sorties a month and then 2 tactical sims. So simulators, and they're supposed to be the equivalent of a sortie. So you're supposed to take off and get to the airspace and fight and then land and all that stuff. So 8 counters, I think, is what the minimum is. I probably do 8 to 10 counters depending on the snow. So some days I'll take leave and go skiing instead. Let's see. So the other part of that question, hey, so there's enough flying, and I could fly more if I wanted to. So Hill does a good job of providing lines to fly. As far as the quality of the training, again, I think probably Hill is, I don't know. I think Eielson has the best airspace. Hill's got pretty decent airspace. And they do, again, it's a big operation. We got 3 giant squadrons. So they put up enough of a front, meaning there's 10 to 12 of us that'll go in a single go. So you can get pretty large fights as well. So the training's pretty good at Hill, I think. What was the second part of the question?
So what's the most fun training mission at F-35? This is, they said, I'm talking about when you get out of the jet, you're thinking, I can't believe they pay me to do this.
I like big exercises. So I hate going to Red Flag because there's a lot that comes with it. It's like everything in the fighter world. There's a lot of pound of flesh to get the good stuff. So I don't like Red Flag in a lot of ways, but I love giant large force exercises in the F-35. Like that's when you're fighting other F-35s, you know, you don't really get a feel for like how dominant it can be in a Red Flag scenario where you're fighting a bunch of fourth gen and even some legacy fifth gen, no offense. You can dominate and it feels good. So you're like, holy crap. Like I see everything. I wish I had more missiles, but you know, we talk about that later. but that's when you're like, this is a sick jet. And, so I like that a lot. The coolest it can do. So we do a lot of like vertical maneuvering. I like that a lot. That's really fun. So to stand the thing up, and the F-35 has a lot of thrust. It can't, you know, the turning, it bleeds at all, but if you're straight and you're in full blower, you can, you know, you're looking out the canopy. You have to avoid the canopy bow that's in the way. So you have to look to the side, which is unfortunate. But to see how high your nose is and the earth is just falling away from you that's pretty righteous. So I dig that.
I love it. Billy, was there something in particular flying the F-35, you know, mission that for you is like, hey, this is awesome. It's a slightly different world doing the test and making it all.
It was, you know, when I had 10 minutes to go play and do anything I wanted to do, it's pretty impressive to maneuver that jet around and just pedal turns and stand it straight up, going straight up and do anything you want to the jet, knowing that you can fly with reckless abandon. I always love that part of it.
I guess for both you guys too, like, you know, I only have the experience with an AOA limiter. I imagine not having an AOA limiter would be kind of a nice thing in a multitude of situations. It's nice when you don't have to like think about, so you like don't get yourself in trouble, but when you want to pull more and you know you can do it, it would be nice to command more AOA.
For me, and you guys talk about it a lot, which I always laugh. I go, you need some Hornet guys to have this in this conversation. To me, it's a Hornet, and it flies like a Hornet. It behaves, every part of the flight control system logic is a lot like the Hornet was, right? So if you're dumb enough to pull too much, then you're going to be a balloon sitting there waiting for everyone to drill you. But it allows you that AOA, it has a pitch capability that's really impressive. And when you choose to use it, it's there and you're not stuck in a limiter. So I flew jets with limiters like a Raptor, the Viper, but you know, I flew Typhoon that had a limiter and you sat there and raged around all day long, pinned at the back, 25 alpha when you really needed more, hoping you could get around the circle faster than the other guy, but I could never bring the nose to bear. And what F-35 does is allows you to do that. It's a lousy rate fight, but guess what? If you understand that mentality. If you're a, I'll give credit to the Marines, a Marine Hornet guy, the transition F-35 is pretty easy because this jet behaves a lot like the jet that they came from. And that's how they fight it. So to me, it's just a better Hornet in a lot of ways in how it flies. And by the way, how it lands, it to me, it's a Hornet mentality. On speed AOA, hit the auto throttle and land that way, put it at the end of the runway and plant it on, and forget the Viper flaring like we're all used to and bouncing down the runway, and less than half the time do we actually do it properly. Just put it down the end of the runway. It's got amazing flight controls for when the gear's down, unlike the Viper. And so fly it and treat it like a Hornet, and then it will seem less awkward in the transition to it.
Excellent. Yeah,
I buy that. So you guys will understand, you know, how you do, we do 6Ks. So a BFM engagement where you start at 6,000 feet in the Viper, and most of us would go straight to guns when you'd get pretty proficient. So as soon as the fight's on, you'd pull your nose and just go straight for the gun. And the problem with that in the Viper is it's hard to bleed off here. So you're on the limiter and you're trying to get your nose out front to gun them. Like that was the difference between the guys who could like really do it well and the guys who couldn't. They just couldn't get their nose out in front to gun, and then they'd have an overshooting problem. But Billy solved that in the F-35. So you can just point at the guy, and then if you don't get your nose out, you just override the limiter, and it puts your nose in front and it bleeds off all that closure. So you can do a straight to guns from 10,000 feet. We do it all the time, which is awesome. So that part is, it's good for the Viper guy. So if you have that, those have patterns from a Viper, and you fly with, like Billy said, reckless abandon and get it, you know, 1,000 to 1,200 feet and are comfortable there, then you can, that nose, it's really helpful to be able to pull that thing around. And
unless you're in a B model and forget you don't have a gun pod, right?
Yeah. I don't know what gun pods do. You could probably cant those things up, right? Get another 20 degrees. So I don't know there's a lot of rumors flying around the F-35 community, and I like to spread them all. But one of them is that the archers that we've done, and this might be different now, but when I first started flying the F-35, they still had yet to hit a banner with the gun in air-to-air, like air-to-air gun testing. So they don't know where the bullets go. So everything looks good, and then you squeeze the trigger and the bullets go straight, but they just don't know where that straight is. So they haven't hit a banner yet. So the joke is that you can get into an air-to-air engagement and you can shoot your 181 rounds, but you know, unless you're pointing randomly at the right spot, you're not going to hit anybody, which is probably good for me. Like I can put bullets around jets all the time. I have trouble putting the batter on, so maybe I'll hit something.
It's just really scary for whoever's out in front. Is it weird with the helmet? I heard it first, the Viper, the HUDs. I've only shot the banner once, and I honestly don't remember. I don't feel like the HUD shook, but you know, when you're strafing, especially in the beginning, like insulation's flying up from the left side of the jet, and I don't know, it's just fast. Is it weird strafing with the helmet or shooting the gun with the helmet?
You know, yeah, the symbology, all that stuff is different enough that it feels pretty weird, and it's not stable at all. Like the HUD's pretty stable. You're not very stable compared to the HUD though. So there's a jittery there, but yeah, it's weird. The symbology is kind of moving, even though you can see on the thing on the ground's not moving that much, but you don't want to aim at the thing on the ground. You want to aim at the symbology. So that gets a little funky. At least the things I've hit, I've had to aim at the symbology. So you got to have a good source that's generating those coordinates.
Put the thing on the thing, not the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You want thing one, not thing two. Or vice versa.
Oh, it's all these little things. All right. This one would be good to have Billy here because I don't think Bender or Vader have experience with this, nor I, but talking about air-to-air refueling. This should be an easy one. Boom or drogue? Air Force uses the boom, but still, which one's better? Are there any particular memories? Was it different? And what, Bill, you got a favorite between doing the boom or the drogue?
Boom refueling's for kids. Manly refueling is probe and drogue. It's it's night and day different. Remarkably hard. So, for the non-aviators, flying formation with underneath a big airliner and staying in a cube in a box to have someone extend a probe into the receptacle in our spine isn't really all it's formation, but it's really not that hard. But probe and drogue is remarkably hard. And the easiest airplane ever to do probe and drogue is the F-35. Hornet was easier. Typhoon was pretty good. F-35's that much easier. But you're trying to, from pre-contact, so let's call it, 10 feet away, you're trying to get your probe into this badminton basket, badminton birdie, like a big size one. And historically, you fly behind with some reference behind the tanker, whether it's a KC-10 or it's a wing pod off a KC-135 or a KC-130, and you try to stabilize the platform that's there and hope that as you approach, the bow wave moves the basket over, pushes by the air, and you connect. And as soon as your eyes look at that basket, it's so funny to watch when you're next to somebody refueling. The nanosecond their eyes look at that basket, the jet starts to move and they start to PIO. And so for everyone, it's hard. That's clear air. Put yourself in turbulence, night, and all of it gets bad and it gets super hard. And there's lots of cases. We certainly had that in combat where you painted a bomb on the left side, and when you ripped a probe or damaged a probe, you got a probe painted on the right side of the jet. F-35 is unique in this sense that so probe and drogue, I talked about all these things moving, and you use a reference, and you've got to get a bow wave to move so the probe connects. F-35 is the first airplane where when you get in it to do probe and drogue refueling, the mentality is, I'm the only one stable and everything else is moving. Because before, you, the Hornet guy, the Super Hornet guy, had to fly a reference and fit it into whatever that airplane was doing. This time we assume that we are not moving and it's all moving, and we try to let it all stabilize to then refuel. It takes a lot of patience to do it. And there's just so many, everybody's got stories. Often it's at night, it's in horrible weather and you need the gas and you're squeezing. So, well, it's the same for us, right? Even on boom refueling, you're squeezing so hard that you're making that side stick turn into molten plastic. You're so terrified of getting in the basket or getting into the basket or not. So no comparison at all. B and C model probe and drogue to an A model. A model's a cakewalk.
It almost seems needlessly difficult, you know? It's like, why make it so tough, you know? It's probably...
to make the boat landing, I guess, not seem as painful. Like, it just keeps the pain threshold high enough.
Yeah. Nah. At least I'm not probe and drogue refueling, right? Thank God.
it sounds terrifying. Yeah, no thanks. I guess you have to have that, you know, so you can have the Super Hornet tanker take off and hold above the ship, you know, when someone bolters for four times. You know, again, these are all reasons to not ever land on a boat, and for that matter, take off from a boat. You know, I'm just saying. I can think of, I know you guys probably have stories like holding on the wing of like a 135 or one, the tanker's like, hey, our autopilot's in op, or we're going to do this autopilot off. And you're like, no, why do we need to do this? Or when like autopilot's on, you're holding, you're like, I know I'm level. And you just see the 135 porpoising 150 feet up and down. You're like, well, this is going to be fun. So the drogue hard.
Yeah.
Pass.
I love, I still remember being on the boom and feeling like we are climbing and then looking through the HUD and seeing the flight path marker, like a degree above the horizon. And I'm like, we're climbing. And then I like see the tanker start like moving down. I'm like, oh gosh, here we go. Like, and you just kind of like ride that wave throughout. So frustrating.
I don't think the 135 now, like they always have autopilot problems. And I think to this day, someone's going to chime in after they listen to this, I'm sure. But like below 10,000 feet with whatever block, like the new block, like it's autopilot and op and has to be hand flown. Granted, you're not doing tanking down there, but it sounds like there's a couple issues with that. So.
Yeah, autopilot's off. I mean, that's the autopilot's the thing that porpoises the stupid airplane. So autopilot off is sometimes the gift, you know. Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Turn that crap off.
Yeah. It's true. It's very true. This is the last listener question I have. I think this one would be pretty easy for all those who've flown around the sandbox quite a bit. But this one's like, hey, when I used to fly around Iraq and Afghanistan, I would hear military aircraft calling Karachi ATC, for instance, and they would say proceed tactical. Can you guys explain what that means? I'll take it. That just pushes a tactical frequency. So usually you're it depends on where you're coming from, but you're transiting with air traffic control. And then areas like Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria, at different points, at different times of different conflicts, that's going to be controlled by military controllers. So by pushing tactical while you might be talking to Pakistani air traffic control or some other nation air traffic control, by pushing tactical, you're going to push over to a military controller. And then subsequently, you might be working with an AWACS, which is going to clear you tactical again. And now you're just going to be talking to a joint terminal attack controller inside whatever area of operations you're working in, et cetera. So I think that's how that tactical term, at least how I used it. So,
you know, this is tactical. I mean,
always tactical. That's
right. I don't understand the question.
This is super petty, but maybe you guys will understand what I'm talking about. I always get annoyed when I tell ATC what I'm doing and then they clear me for it. And I'm like, hey, switching frequency. And they're like, oh, you're cleared to switch frequency. Like, I wasn't asking. Like, I don't care.
I've already switched at that point.
That's right. But now I'm going to stay.
Yeah, exactly. Don't tell me what to do. Yeah.
I think those are some good questions from the acquisition, you know, piece of it, which again is, I mean, that's several books in and of itself. And how do you fix that? So just scratch the surface. But Billy, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about that. And then, yeah, just some good Patreon questions. So thanks for supporting the podcast.
Look at that. Thanks, Patreon. Yeah. People love Patreon.
Yeah. So do you
go ahead?
No, Vader, you go. It's Vader, you get the talking stick.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, we've been talking about all these advanced fighters, and you know what I've come to appreciate is not having to go to submenus for switches now. Like, you know, where it's like, hey, go to like this menu page and then go to this sub page and then click the button to go from like X-ray to Yankee on your air attack end. Instead, it's just like a steel switch. And you're like, that's nice. That's convenient, you know. I've heard pushing buttons in the 35 is not always awesome.
It's not. Fat fingering buttons that's a real thing in a 35. I can't ever hit a zero to save my life. It's always 8. I don't know why. I think it was a joke. Maybe the engineers like slightly moved the touch screen for the 8 larger than every other button is, but
it's a laser. Yeah. It's a laser plane, right? Like your finger breaks the laser plane to touch the screen.
I have no idea. Billy?
Yeah, so it's not like your iPhone. It's not the touch here. You're breaking an IR plane with your finger, and where you take it off is where it's actuated. Yeah. Because we're using gloves. Yeah.
So where you remove your hand from the IR plane is actually, so you could break the plane, move your finger to the right spot and then release, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I do. If it's like bad weather or night, I'll just like plant my finger on the screen, look at whatever else I'm looking at, and then drag it.
So
the thing I'm trying to hit.
In the C model, it's got a horrible bounce from the nose gear. And when you're taxiing out, it's impossible to type as you're taxiing. And I'd actually have to put my fingernails at the top of the PCD, the display, to center it or to hold it, and then I would be typing with my thumb because it's bouncing along the way as you're texting along. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to type.
Is the voice activation, like I've heard once you get used to that, is decent, but apparently not.
I don't know if I have a Canadian accent, an Aussie accent, an American accent. It never worked for me.
I have never heard of anybody using it. Yeah. So I don't think it's a feature that is commonly explored.
Do people use Siri? Like, I don't use Siri on my phone, which now is going to chime in on all of ours, but that's one, like, I just haven't come around to like saying, hey Siri, set a reminder for this, which, yep, there it goes. It just chimed in. It's gonna be a long reminder. So I wonder like if that is a difficult thing to.
So I'll tell you that the base of the root of the algorithms for F-35 is the same thing. It's the same as Siri. Now an F-35, it doesn't get fed to the cloud like the billion users of an Apple iPhone, which enhances how good Siri has become from way back when to now. I don't use Siri either. So you don't get feedback from the cloud, but really the engine is the same as was developed for Siri in the beginning. And I know that because I shit all over a guy in a conference one time when he told me that he was the guy that was responsible for voice, you know, voice activation. And I told him how it didn't work. And he said, like, sorry, but, you know, it's as good as an Apple phone minus the feedback into the cloud. But I don't use it. I didn't use it in Typhoon. It had a different algorithm in Typhoon or a different logic, but it didn't work there either. And it doesn't work for me in F-35. And it must be my half Canadian accent. I don't know, but I can't get it to work.
It seems like nobody can.
Yeah, no, right? Hey, here's a random thing. Best friend Fiddy Tucker, he was staying at my house this weekend, F-35 guy. But Billy, so there's a couple clips of you from the last episode, which one of them, which I don't know if you can classify as viral, but it'd be viral for this podcast. What is talking about the fighter pilot performance, and we knew there's gonna be people that chime in with like, you know, prima donnas, etc. Which are a couple of those comments, like to be expected, but there's a lot of likes. But apparently, there are several people in that OWS world, the physical therapy world, that saw it, and I think they want to have you come speak. Because one thing Fiddy and I were talking about was the life support conference, where there's no operators that show up to the life support conference, but all these decisions are being made without operator input, and then you get product. Hey, here's the product, and there's the ship sailed. There's no going back, and we're 10 years down the procurement process. So, sucks to be you.
It really. There was one female fighter pilot from Hill, Rig Force, and I chatted with her before one of the speaking conferences or one of the presentations. But there's no fighter pilots there. They're physiologists. Lots of people walking around in flight suits, but they're not wearing pilot wings. And, you know, they're not operators, so how could they possibly know what we need? And that's masks, that's LPUs, right? That's flashlights, that's every piece of kit that we use. Tell us about parachutes and what's new, and tell us about new ejection seats, and let us get in the argument. Do we want to continue with a Martin Baker seat, or do we want a Collins seat? Look, I want to, if I'm an operator, I want all the operators there to understand so there can be an educated conversation about it. I don't want some folks that are working in our best interests, but never been in a jet, don't know what we really need.
Does the 35 have the same lip light as the F-16? Because I know it's a different helmet. I don't know if the mask is the same.
They're working on it, but they don't have it right now.
So there's a backlog. Maybe the backlog has been corrected, but for the F-16, for lip lights, or for the general like 55P mask lip light, for anybody who's never used a lip light, think about, obviously you have the controls and the throttles, or throttle depending on what aircraft you're in. And so your hands are kind of occupied. So you can't like turn on and off a light very conveniently. And back in the day, you used to like Velcro. What's that? Oh, you used to Velcro like little lights, like finger lights is what they call. And you click them on and you point at what you want to look at. And then somebody came up with the idea for a lip light. And effectively, it's the light is on the front of your mask. So wherever you're looking, the light goes. And then you can click the light on and off with your lip or your tongue or whatever you're going to use, probably, so to speak, somewhere in there. And then they were all backlogged. So then somebody came up with the idea to 3D print these like huge cubes that now sit on the front of your mask. And they were like, lip light problem solved. But again, not getting the end user feedback. I finally was like, hey, you understand, like, I can't turn that on without touching the front of my mask to turn the light on, going back to the controls, and then turning the light off. And they were like, is that a problem? I'm like, that was the whole point of the lip light. I didn't have to do that. Like, but it's, you know, not getting the complete, you know, picture or problem set from the operator.
Yeah, in the F-35, the night operations are so different than they were in the F-16. And that's part of the tactics. We fly pretty far apart, and the night vision, the NVIS is not very functional, not functional, I would say, for me at least. Anyway, so I just have all the lights on in the cockpit of an F-35 anyway. Maybe that's bad if, you know, people are shooting from the ground, but I'm pretty high. I don't think they could hit me from that direction or that distance. Still. Yeah. So anyway, I have like the canopy or whatever, those little, what are those, eyebrow lights? Is that what they're called? Anyway, so those are full blast. Everything else is pretty full blast. So the lip light, I don't miss the lip light. So that's the that's the F-35 version of night. I mean, it's just be as bright as you want, basically.
A lip light was like a no-go item for me.
Viper for sure.
Yeah, one of my worst sorties ever was a night red flag. On departure, my lip light went out. And I was like, this, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to make it. And then there was no chance of a 03 recovery, like the runway 03, right? 03. And during the vol, they swap runways, which for those who haven't been to red flag, especially at night, that is the worst recovery. Like, cause it's like an arcing approach, which like, how do I do this? I haven't done this in a while. Like the final, and they're like lining up on the run or on the taxiway. That's a terrible experience. No lip light and that approach. Not where you want to be.
Yeah. When I was at the FTU at Holloman, I went two separate FTU classes of nights, which is normally 5 to 6 weeks long without a lip light. And I got back in and one of the like guest flyers was like, you legitimately should not fly until they fix that. And then a week later, they gave me the janky like 3D printed lip light, which was nice, but did not solve the problem. I had multiple sorties where I'm like, I want to go home. I'm done. Like I'm so over this. Like, I'm not having a good time.
Yeah, flying at night in the Viper, I mean, that is probably the most task intensive, just labor intensive flying, I would think, that you can do. Maybe there's some special ops low level helicopter flying in formation that's pretty rough, but a four ship of Vipers trying to operate, you know, at night that's pretty rough and scary at times.
One question I had about, so now that I'm flying in the C model, I have to figure out like my new ways of like flying defensive BFM and like looking back and everything. So I always would use the Block 50 had the glass for the HUD. I could kind of put my hand up there and kind of turn myself because there were no canopy bow or anything. Does the 35 have like a good way to kind of reorient in the seat while you're fighting?
Yeah, it has the canopy bow has little handles.
Handles?
So I just grab the opposite one and you can pull across and look. Yeah. But the problem is the helmet just like falls down. So if you look like outside of, you know, 45 degrees, then, and it's baseball hat-ish. So it has like a, I don't know, like a little bill. And then
like the DU
down.
Kind of shelf on it?
Yeah, but far, it's way worse, yeah, than the DU. So
how do you do defensive BFM?
You try not to get there, which is, you know, the 35 is designed to get there. So that's pretty tough. Yeah. I don't know. Check and extend like an eagle.
Yeah. Exactly. Check and extend.
Tell us about that, Vader.
Yeah. It's, it's funny. Somebody posted on one of the Kodiak Shack podcast videos, like on YouTube. They were like, hey, you seem like you're not really excited about flying the C model. And I tried to explain it. Like, it's not exactly that I'm flying the C model that is not exciting. It's that I'm not good at flying the C model. So, you know, obviously Billy and Bender were talking about the F-35 and you can kind of fly with reckless abandon. If there is a plane you cannot fly with reckless abandon, it is the C model, the F-15C. You have to, care and feeding is part of the game plan to the point where, you know, so you have up to 50 units, what's called CPU or cockpit units of AOA, which is different than true AOA. Roughly subtract 10 plus or minus 3 is the exact calculation I've been told.
That's a classified formula, isn't it, Andrew?
Yeah. You're running those numbers.
They told me maybe, we'll edit that out, but either way, but really you're not flying at the max extent of the CPU or the cockpit units available. So I don't know if the 35 can just live its life at 50 or 60 units, but you're really living in that like 30, high 30s, low 40s. So there are a lot of times where I will ease off the backstick pressure in the controls to quote, break the AOA. But what I'm really doing is going from like 47 units of AOA, which is doing nothing, to 42 units of AOA, which is also doing nothing. And then I'm like, why isn't this thing flying? And most of my like audio during the fights is like, come on, girl. Oh, Jesus. You know, and the jet's like flipping off the wrong direction and stuff. So it's, a lot of it is being in tune with the airplane, you know, the Mice on the Wings and the Moderate Wing Rock and the Heavy Wing Rock. So far, I don't notice it. I just am watching myself get gunned and I'm like, move, you know.
Does the F-35 have wing rock? I mean, you get elephants on the wings?
It's got pretty significant. Well, it's got Buffett. I think we use it to tell us how the jet's flying. It's nothing like so many other jets that we're really, it's nothing like a T-38. But yeah, there's Buffett there. Yeah.
That's only my experience. Yeah, the T-38, which I thought was like kind of nice, you know, having that feedback to a certain extent. The Viper, you just kind of like, it's getting really quiet. Oh man, I'm really slow right now. Fall asleep. Yes. Yeah. Dang it, be better.
I have noticed.
Like, I remember the F5, which is just a glorified T-38. I remember an IP in fighter lead-in training going, you know, if you pull just a little harder, we're both going to die, as the elephants are pounding on the wing. Right? Yeah, I got it. Okay.
Got to take it to the limit. Just find the line. Yeah. Don't go over it, the line of death. But just max form the airplane. No big deal. It's like Top Gun Maverick. It's a 7.5 G, but it's going to be a 10 G pull out of that canyon to, you know, a bunch of SA-17s just lighting up the sky, you know? Just take it to the limit.
I like how they just in training just over G'd the heck out of all those planes. Like maintenance would be like, again? Like 10 G's? Like what? Oh my gosh, you know, like that must have cost so much.
We just scrapped 12 jets this week, straight to the boneyard, put them on sticks.
You know, one thing, because the C model, it's not fly-by-wire. It has like hydraulics, you know, so you're making an input into what's called a CAS, which is like a, we'll call it like a poor man's flight control, like a FLCS, like a flight control system, where it doesn't run the show. It just helps get you more surface deflection. So more rudder deflection, more aileron, more stabs, but you still make the inputs. But what it doesn't do is like take in these like inherent aerodynamic problems that happen. Like as you slow down through like low corner and all those, the jet will kind of like lean to like list to the right or list to the left. Does the F-35 have any of those characteristics? Like, hey, under a lot of alpha, as you slow down, does the jet just like keep the nose track smooth and keep you, you know, in the relative lift vector that you had?
I'll have to answer just for fighting it, and then I'll just talk about what it's supposed to do.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, well, send it. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm the ham fist guy. But yeah, I mean, it feels like a Viper to me in that regard. Like the Viper has some, it gives you little jittery wings, I think, when you're, like if you're trying to sustain airspeed in like a hot in or whatever, hot turn, you can feel in the Viper when it starts to shake a little bit, you'd start to bleed knots. The F-35 does the same thing, but that's about the extent of the feedback. Like you can rip the thing to an AOA overshoot and get really slow, and it's just nice. It just falls or whatever it does, sinks. It doesn't like tip off or anything like that. There's no feedback like that. You just kind of do your thing and try not to hit the floor.
It's a pretty honest jet. It really has fabulous flight controls. It's a great department in Lockheed Martin, flight dynamics, as they're called. They really are rock stars in terms of engineers that know how to do flight control system. They had history with F-16. They did thrust vectoring way back when. They did a Raptor and probably some other projects along the way. And they really, really knew what they were doing. And they've done a really amazing job, or had during development, of finessing the flight control system to make it fly as honestly as it did. I really dislike the 35 alpha limiter. It came in sort of backdoored by some good friends of mine, Marine test pilots who didn't.
Classic.
Yeah, they did BFM, a couple Navy lieutenants and Marine major. We're doing BFM early on in the C model and harped upon it, and then backdoored the process and knew who to go talk to in the flight control engineers, and got the limiter in before the rest of us could stop it. I liked the jet before it had it. And the limiter really does help. It keeps you honest at 35 alpha and lets you fly all you want. And then when you need it just to go beyond, that's not not hard. And what it probably does is save guys and gals from going right to 50 alpha too early and getting themselves, you know, becoming a Zeppelin out there and pissing away all their energy early. So it probably does have some effect. I liked the jet better when it didn't have a limiter.
Is it kind of like the Raptor? I've heard people talk about how the F-22 has kind of like a soft limiter. So you pull back to the limiter, and then as you exceed the soft limiter, that's where you'll actually get your AOA excursions and stuff. Or how do you actually access that additional alpha?
Yeah, Bender, do you use it? Do you pull past the limiter often enough?
Yeah, every BFM fight, I'll usually do that a couple times, just depending on the phase of the fight. But yeah, I exceed the, because it's the paddle, I'm pretty sure, or a button. Anyway, yeah, we call it the win button.
Give me more.
Are you doing that? You're not doing that in like a stack or a tree, whatever they call it. No. Like if you ever, you're not, because you're not trying to stop the jet. Like
no, I'll only do it like when I'm, yeah, end game of a pretty aggressive, like pulling for the guns, then I'll use it. Or, I mean, it's pretty awesome. It's the best part of the F-35. Like the fighting slow speed close aboard is awesome. It's a good time. So if if in a Viper, you would never, you know, that's why the 6K straight to guns is so risky. Like any heading crossing angle, it exceeds a certain amount and you're screwed in an F-16. But an F-35, like you can, it's really forgiving because you can just squat that away and pull past that limiter. It gets your nose lined and then you're completely out of energy, which is what you want when you're, 1,200 feet behind somebody. So in that regard, that's when I'll use it, just to kind of align my nose and stop closure end game. But if you used it like in a stack or something like that, I mean, it's just going to bleed all your, the energy loss is pretty significant, I guess I'd say.
Like you wouldn't climb out of it. Like you wouldn't set your nose pitch like a stack and then be able to climb out of it or just power.
No, it'd cost you too much to do something like that. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't stack. It doesn't stack like a Viper stacks, like a Block 50. It's just too heavy, I think.
So the first time the first time I stacked against not another F-16, I was like, this is amazing. I stacked against a Legacy Hornet. And then like out of nowhere, I was like 6,000 feet above him. I was like, this is pretty cool. Like this stack thing really works. I try not to compliment Navy things, but I feel like the Hornet is kind of like a great balance, having flown the F-16 and then now flying the F-15C, you look at it and you're like, wait, there is a flight control computer like the F-16 that can just allow a plane to fly like an F-15C. And you're like, why wouldn't you want that? Like a computer can help you pull AOA and help you do rudder turns and help you do all that stuff. Like, I would buy that because I am terrible at that stuff. I tell you what, it's not good. So Billy, I assume you're a big fan of that kind of the Hornet flight control system.
Especially go back. So you really to date me, right? I flew it 40 years ago, first time. And it was just so eye watering because you could do absolutely anything with it. It'll let you go out of control, but it'll come back in control. And I've told the story of departing the F-35 and it was like, back to being a Hornet. and guys who are really good, the A model was the best of them because it was the lightest. You could stand this thing straight up on its tail and rudder over at slow speed. Now with the flight control logic that really is a product of what went into Super Hornet, it's even more departure resistant. And it's a fabulous, such a simple airplane to fly and fly aggressively and be good at it within what the what the Hornet can do. So different than the Viper where you're just stuck on a limiter and you're just going around the circle fast, trying to go faster than everyone else. And rudders don't do anything. You know, rudders matter in a Hornet. They really, really help you slow speed.
Yeah, I used them in the demo to slow down. That was about it. That's probably not a flight control approved maneuver, just stomping on the rudder, trying to rejoin with the Mustang.
I got a question for Billy. Yeah. Sorry, Rain, you're going to go somewhere.
No. Like, I want to get to the, you, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's not a crazy question. This is the Neanderthal, obviously, version of the question. If you like the F-35's engine is massive. It's awesome. Like it's got so much thrust. Why don't we just put it in a Block 50? Like what happens? What do we trade as far as, like, surviving, if you get that much thrust,
you know, like you could put some, there's a lot of thrust in an F-35 engine. If you put that in a Block 50, pretty light airframe like that, like what happens? Is that a bad idea?
Yeah, it's just too big to fit in there. And there's too much logic that goes with it, right? So FedEx are an entirely different generation than what we had in the Viper. Even in Block 60, which had 132,000 pounds of thrust out of that monster engine, you just can't, you can't fit it all in there. And the logic that goes with it and everything that drives the AI that goes into running that engine, you can't put somewhere else. It, when you look at it, so Ben, I don't know if you've gone to the engine shop and looked at it, but it doesn't look like we're all used to looking at fighter engines, and they're relatively fragile. We get it, right? The fan blades in the first couple rows are all so finely tuned, and we know that every stage along the way, everything is so finely tuned. And the F-135 is so much more like a commercial engine. It's so much, it's more robust than anything that we are used to. And I think Pratt leveraged their experience with commercial engines to finally put them into a military engine. So you don't have to baby this thing like we did in all the engines that we've ever flown in our military career. And when I talk about it, because I get asked a lot of questions about one engine versus two in the Arctic and across the ocean, I always go, hey, look, it's more like a commercial engine than anything that any of us have ever seen. And it's an incredibly smart engine, right? So the health system in F-35 looks ahead, and it's preventative in a sense, prognostic in a sense that it's looking ahead at what it might need. You don't have to wait till 5,000 miles to change your oil. It's looking ahead saying, you know what, in this many hours, based on how you're using it, you're going to need to do this to the engine. And oh, by the way, the engine in the airplane right next to it isn't being used the same way, so it's not going to take the same maintenance cycle along the way. All throughout that engine, it has that kind of logic in it, and redundancies upon redundancies that just don't exist in any other previous generation. Really an offshoot from F-119 and Raptor, where Pratt got a great start at it and then just made it that much better. And like, it's 43,000 pounds of thrust. Dear God, that's a lot of power.
Yeah, it's awesome. Too bad the jet's so freaking heavy.
I'll tell you one thing that's really interesting. So we had an in-thrust vectoring, and Bender knows this, but you guys are all used to looking at the back cans of an engine, and when we light the afterburner, A8 is where the afterburner starts, and then we open up the back of it, right? And that's A9 as you work through the sections of the engine. But in F-35, it was actually the same in the thrust vectoring engine that we did in MATV back in the early 90s. A8, so the beginning of the afterburner section, it moves also and does the back of it. And the fuel efficiency of being able to control that second last stage of the engine and then through the nozzle in is significant. And it's where we get the efficiency in this engine that was never available in any previous generation of fighter engines. It's really one of the remarkable things about this engine.
I know GE is obviously competing. We talked about, you mentioned two motors. There is a term out there for next generation, like engine or adaptive engine. What is that program? You know what I'm talking about? This is something that the Secretary of the Air Force was, I think it popped up like 6 months ago, and I might just be off down a rabbit trail and you can cut me off. But the whole program to have an adaptive smart engine, it was the next version of this. And maybe it is Pratt and GE competing for the F-35 replacement engine. Is this crazy?
Well, I'll tell you a couple of things of it. It's purported to be $6 billion for a GE engine to go in there. That's the equivalent of 72 F-35s that would be on the ramp right now. And if anyone thinks that a brand new engine will be developed seamlessly, let's go back to Block 30 when the F-110 was put into the Viper and ran into all the oil problems before we eventually figured out how to manage that. Anyone believes that we won't lose a jet or trash a bunch of engines developing a brand new General Electric engine to put in an F-35 is terribly, horribly naive. And we've all been burned with F-35 development to know that nothing works like you plan. So $6 billion or 72 F-35s on the ramp, to me, that's pretty simple math when we don't have enough fighters out there right now. It is true that we need more, well, Bender's going to need more power, more electrical power generated by the engine moving through to TR3 and into block four. Okay. And that's not going to come from the engine the way it is right now. So something has to change, either significant improvements to the Pratt engine, which you've probably read about, or somebody would make the bad decision of putting in a whole new other engine in there. And then you would get the power generation to drive what's going to be needed in the jet, because it won't be satisfied with the engine the way it is right now. That's my start. I'll let the rest to Bender.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, that's really interesting. We don't get us think about that kind of stuff, or we don't talk about that kind of stuff. You know, I had no idea that the engine, that there was a power issue, electrical power issue from the generation of what we have now and how that affects block four. I mean, block four is really important to the F-35, because right now the F-35, it's great. Like, it's tactically, you know, it's really good. It's the best option for surviving in an advanced environment, but it is not what it is meant to be as far as its weapons capabilities and all the things that it can do. So right now it's kind of like a Gen 4 weapons. It's a Gen 5 or Generation 5 aircraft, rather, 5th gen with 4th gen like fighting capability, you know. And that's unfortunate. When it gets its full capability, I think then it's going to be, you know, that's the good stuff. And so I had no idea that it was reliant kind of on future development of, you know, the motor and stuff. I know there's one of the pilots in our squadron. He was a DT pilot for the F-35, just got hired, but you know, he's got good things to say about block four, but also bad things to say about the kind of the DT timeline for it and how delayed it is. It's probably stuff like that that goes into it, but just like so frustrated with how long it's taking to get the thing, you know, advancing. So we'll see what ends up happening. It won't be me. I'll be, by the time, you know, it's fully capable, I probably will be, you know, doing something else is my guess.
It's unfortunate how long these things take. You know, I feel like, you know, Billy, you probably didn't get to see the programs that you worked on get as far along as you would have hoped. And then all of us are going to be retired by the time the stuff that we're looking towards actually becomes a reality. And it's, man, be sweet, you know, if we could roll them off the line faster.
No, it's so frustrating. So I joined Typhoon at the beginning as a German and lived in Munich. And we had seven prototypes that were called developmental aircraft, DAs. And we Germans had the first jet and the fifth jet of the seven. And I thought I'd be flying my butt off, like these brand new airplane, brand new program. We're going to be working 7 days a week. And none of that ever happened, right? Unstable avionics. I have 1,000 strap-ins for 200 hours in a Typhoon because nothing ever worked. And then you come to F-35 and that wasn't a great start. That wasn't a sprint from the beginning like everybody promised. It was just crawling, not crawl, walk, run. It crawled and crawled and crawled. And in the end, we did pretty good. But wow, it took a long time to get going. It was just so many heartaches to get things working. Some of it's just really hard. Regression, when we had a legacy program and a federated systems, like an Eagle, like in a Hornet, like in Viper, when you upgrade a radar, then you just upgrade the radar. And so the work you do, the regression you do is to look at the radar. But an F-35, just like Raptor, you know, everything's so integrated and fused that regression, even in the system integration laboratories, so, you know, in Fort Worth in the laboratories, just that work there is exhaustive because you have to test so many elements of it. And inevitably, you're going to send out a software release that's going to have lots of bugs in it that are going to be found by OT or as soon as it gets to the squadrons. And you can't avoid that, and you can't cheat the very long, painful element of that regression. And we certainly tried an F-35 along the way. People wanted to make it quicker and more efficient, and there is no quickness to it. And there's no efficiency to it. It's just so painful. So getting block four going with really magic that Bender hasn't seen yet, that I hadn't seen, but by all accounts is so eye-watering, that's just beyond painful. And we should look back at Raptor. Raptor used to have a saying, it was 7 years of 7 days a week when they couldn't get the airplane stable and they couldn't make fusion work and nothing was happening, right? They parked a general officer in the combined test force of the F-22 to supervise what was going on because it was so troublesome and it just wasn't going anywhere. And we really aren't much different in F-35. It's just remarkably hard. The smartest people put them all in the room, and it's just really hard to do regression and make sure you checked off all the boxes and then go fly with it, you know, and hope that's going to work, which it's not going to, which sends you back into lab, and all of that's really hard.
Is there any argument? Because I feel like what we keep doing is building, and I'm stealing this from, I think, Paco and whoever else, but like we keep building exquisite technology after exquisite technology that takes decades to produce, like rather than just like, you know, Sopwith camels or, you know, P-51s, where it's like, hey, it's minimal, but man, we can produce a lot of them quickly. And it's, we don't have all of this iterative process to get it out the door. Like, is there something to be said about just a cheap alternative to one of these amazing platforms, but platforms that take a long time to make?
Oh, so I'll start, and then we'll ask Bender how many people he kills every time they go out in a LFE and slaughters, you know, everyone out there. I've flown the airplanes with compromise, right? I flew Tornado first, which is just a heap of crap. That is just an astonishing effort by the navigator and the chauffeur in the front to make work. The amazing crews that made that airplane. No part of that airplane is elegant. And I came from a Viper and a Hornet before I went to it. And it just told me what engineering compromise was like. And then I flew Typhoon, which is as mediocre as you could ever imagine for an airplane that had such an astonishing, amazing future when I joined it. It would have been Raptor-like, had the potential, and they just gave up just to get airplanes off the line. They just checkmarked all the boxes in engineering and said, let it go. And it's nothing now today like it promised to be back in the day. So do we spend too much time making the exquisite products? Yeah. And we actually changed the world. Like we define the future. Raptor did that. F-35 is changing minds all around the world, and it's driving multi-mission ops, right? We're going to have not just joint operations, but we are going to change the future, start throwing in drones at some point, and nobody else could have imagined that. So, sorry for the background noise. I have a two-year-old puppy that's really badly behaved, scratching at a door. So, do we spend too much and too much time? Yeah, probably. Do we change the world? Absolutely. And throwing more airplanes up there, that's what the Chinese are going to do against us. They're going to throw crappy J-20s out there and whatever else they can. And Bender's going to have to shoot 3-1, 4-1 out there.
What about 5-1 or 6-1?
I'm going to need more missiles. That's yeah. The beef.
Well, I was wondering when we were going to get there.
Yeah.
So when are we getting to the missile talk?
I want to know why we only have 4 missiles. Like, how did that pass your test, Billy? You're like, nope, send it back.
Sidekick, 6 missiles.
Yeah, bring me Sidekick. Come on.
It's coming.
Yeah, I'm an American studies background, so I have no like dog in this fight at all. But I want thrust vectoring, and I want 8 missiles. So somebody make it happen for me.
Yeah, I need more missiles. Can I throw something just in your out because I don't want to lose it? The ejection seat in F-35 and the arm restraints that word of mouth from Hill says that it came from the B model.
And that actually, that's we need to go to Luke because that is what they teach you egress, like at Luke. Like this is from the B model.
Which none of that's true.
Yeah, interesting.
None of that's true. Martin Baker 16, which is the same, it's really the same ejection seat that's in Typhoon. A fabulous ejection seat, very laborious strap-in procedure. It's very British. If you've ever flew a Brit Hawk or Tornado or even actually a Canadian Hornet in the earlier Martin Baker series, it's just a migration of or enhancement or improvement of those seats. Leg garters, every Hornet guy is used to strap in these running lines through the garters along their calves and along their thighs, which bring in the legs during ejection. And then in Tornado, we had arm restraints, and it's to bring the arms in so that there isn't arm flail, especially during high-speed ejections. And there's a case, so way back in your Viper lore, you may have remembered the story of a guy at Eglin going, I'll butcher the story, but he was like 840 knots somewhere out over the water. You know, the engine threw a bunch of blades, airplane disintegrated. He ejects or gets thrown out, and he drowned because his shoulders, his shoulders are broken because his arms have flailed. SeaWorks didn't activate, and he ended up drowning because he didn't have any control of his hands. And it's the arm flail conversation at high speed ejection. So in the Martin Baker 16 seat, like Typhoon has, which I flew and then got into this airplane, go, hey, same ejection seat. It has passive leg restraints. So the netting is up around where we put our feet so that when we pull the ejection seat, it's going to, those ropes or wires or cords are going to come in and bring our legs in. We don't have active garters like we did in the Hornet. And the arm restraints, it's going to drive those things to bring our arms in, so we're not going to suffer arm flail and damage in high-speed ejection. It has nothing to do with the B model. Nothing to do with the B model. I'm not a big fan of the strap-in procedure. It's very British, and Brits, in how they design things, it's all driven by scientists and engineers and not by operators. But the reality is it's a really effective ejection seat. And the logic of keeping the pilot's legs from flailing and the arms from flailing is really sound. So that's where the arm restraints and all of that come from. Now, there is thermal overload that happens because Brits don't deal in 110 degree heat at Edwards Air Force Base or Yuma, Arizona, or Luke. And we're freaking hot walking to a jet, right? Like, we're boiling because we're wearing a big jacket on top of a big G suit. Which, by the way, is better than any American G suit I ever wore. It has an unfortunate name. They're called faggots, full coverage anti-G trousers. I told the Brits way back when, went, that's an unfortunate name. You need to change that. But it's an amazing G suit. Amazing G suit. And it's just hot for us to wear. Very British. We can't probably change that right away. We probably should have tried harder. But the whole ensemble and the ejection seat, like we know so far, looks pretty damn good.
But yeah, the video of the B model guy punching out. I mean, that's a pretty good testament to how good that seat is.
That was a spicy spot to be in. Yeah. I did want to say, you at least can't blame the canopy bow on the B model, right? We can at least point the, can we at least dog on the Marines here just a little bit? But no, that seeing the ejection seat work last weekend or 2 weeks ago in Fort Worth and him walk, I mean, safe from it is pretty impressive.
So years ago, I was in the Isle of Man off the coast of the United Kingdom, and I was talking about AutoGCast, and I got a tour of the facility that builds the propellants that go in the ejection seats. And at the very end, it was all very nice to go through. It was pretty fun to go through this factory, but at the end, they had every Martin Baker ejection seat from 1 to 16. And it's the first time that I've actually seen that all we're sitting on are rock or mortar shells, right? That's all the sophistication of the sequenced ejection. That's a crock. That's just three different size mortars that you're sitting on. And the early ones, like a Martin Baker 2 or 3, you're just sitting on one mortar shell. And it's just firing underneath your butt. And it doesn't give you any more confidence to find out that you're sitting on three mortar shells in a Martin Baker 16 seat. Now, if I'd ever seen that before I started flying, I wouldn't have flown ejection seats.
Hey, so we're probably getting close to our time, but there was two things that Bender sent three things Bender sent. So I don't know if we have enough time to go through them, but one, Bender brought up a good point. He wanted to share something about the Paveway and its origin because he studied on that. There was a Vader and Bender story from his IPUG DCA ride. But then we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but it'd be a great time. This Billy just kind of crushed one of these WOMs that we brought up in the last bro chat with the B model and the arm restraints. But like a Bender and Billy time where Bender can bring up something from the F-35 and then Billy can correct him.
Yeah, that's pretty much everything I know about the F-35. Probably needs correction from Billy. So that's probably a whole nother podcast series.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. No, I'll skip we can talk about the Paveway 2 later, but I do need to throw an instant justice out at Vader. I've been waiting a long time for this.
So it's not instant?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But it's always just.
It is just. I don't know. I'd like to hear Vader's side. Even though I've heard it multiple times, but I was in my instructor pilot upgrade, which was pretty traumatic for me because I'm not very good at what I do. But I was towards the end in the defensive counter air mission. So I think I had that one, and then I had like three seed rights, and then I was going to be done finally. And so this DCA mission, though, was like one of our Misawa standard. We brought up a couple squadrons from, where was it, Kadena. So there were some C models. There were Japanese C models. There were Japanese F2s. So it was this huge LFE, two lanes, tankers in each lane. AWACS was there. So my mission prep for this DCA ride was just like extensive. So we put all this effort in, and we get to the fight, and we're like shooting stuff and killing things, and like we're just raging. I'm like winning hard, so to speak. And then from across the lane is Vader. He's the Red Air flight lead. So an Eagle shoots Vader, calls him dead. Vader acknowledges the kill call. And then as he's turning to go back to the red regen point, he crosses the lane. He sees me in the other lane. And he just for fun, he just shoots at me a couple times, which is a spins violation because you're supposed to drop lock CCA and then go back to your old point. So Vader shoots me and then he goes back to his point. In the debrief, we think Vader's dead, but it turns out that that Eagle guy's tapes did not run. So he's like, stop, I called the kill here. It's like, my tapes didn't run, $5. So they're like, okay, well, you're going to kill or move colored. And Vader's like, well, actually, I have, you know, a factor time or whatever. He's like, I took shots at Bender after I was dead, so I'm going to call those. So I get whited out and killed in this stupid debrief. And so we get back to my individual four-ship debrief. My flight lead's like, or my instructor's like, hey, that was pretty good. Like, good job, put that all together. Like, target didn't get bombed. We did really well. But you died, and you can't die in an IPUG ride, so you're going to see that one again. And I lost it. So, thank you for that. It was awesome.
I'm so sorry. I do apologize. I think I was trying to challenge the title. So anybody from Misawa knows what I'm talking about. But so our first patch, Bender's my first patch, Jikto, awesome dude. I was super young. I don't even think I was out of MQT, or if I was, it was very shortly after. And he's like, big day, big day. And he's like tightening up his G suit because he's the patch. And our DO was a black border patch and he was red air. So our Jikto was red air that day. He's like, I'm going to challenge the title. Like, you always have to try to kill like the most tactical dude on the other side on blue air just to like, hey, you know, like see if I can. So I apologize for doing that on your instructor pilot upgrade and really just not shut my mouth and letting it go.
Oh no, I have a factor time I would like to.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, well, I need everybody to know. Yeah. I was sorry.
Nah, it was funny. No, it was a good memory. I was probably gonna see it again just because that was how the iPug was going for me, but that was like one of my stronger rides. I'm like, mother effer.
You know, one of my silver lining here was C models were repping a pretty at that time, because this was like 2015. Like it was a long time ago. We're repping a pretty advanced threat at the time, and the samurai, so the other squadron in Misawa, were in the bullpen just capping. So they were technically part of the fight, but they didn't think they were part of the fight. So the C models, instead of targeting the guys in the lane, just shot the guys capping. So the samurai have like two people killed while they're just sitting there in the cap because the C models shot them at range, and we're like, hey, you didn't maneuver, so you're dead. And that made me, as bad as I feel for you, Bender, for doing that, I feel that good about them getting killed in the bullpen. Because that made
That's funny. Yeah, it was good. It's good memories. Yeah, Misawa was pretty pushed up. There was some good air-to-air airspace. So you could get a lot of jets out there fighting each other. It was awesome.
I mean, it was like automatic 120-mile look like every day. It was good. So Bill, you said sidekick. So it's going to be six AMRAMs in the weapons base.
Yeah, plumbed for lot 15 and later, if I have my numbers right. Three in each in the bay, and it just stuffs them in. There's not, so Bender's been there. There's not a lot of room. You put a 2,000-pound bomb and a AMRAM in there. It's pretty impressive how tight it is. And it's a pretty impressive engineering feat to put three missiles in each bay and make it all work the way the contraption's set. But everybody knew that we need more missiles. So yeah, sidekicks. And sidekicks an answer for a lot of people in a lot of nations. It's a big deal in Canada when we talk about hordes coming over the Arctic, you know, the North Pole and coming in the Arctic. It's everybody in Eielson, well, you know, everybody needs more missiles. So it's a factor for the entire F-35 family.
Is that for Block 15 and on, or is that a modification?
The modification to be able to accommodate it, because it there's structural elements of that, or where it feeds in, but we're happening in Lot 15 in the builds. That doesn't mean that they're not coming out with Sidekick there, but you had to get into the structure of the airplane through the weapons bays to create the stability, I guess you'd say. So that's where it pushed in.
Yeah. Interesting.
So is that pretty much the future 6x0? So no heat seeking missiles for the 35?
Ask Bender about that, but I'm thinking you're 6x2, but
yeah, it just depends on the threat environment. 6x0 if we're trying to, you know, be our best LO, and then 6x2 if we're not as worried about that. So we'll see. Yeah, it's a small weapons bay. Honestly, like, it's impressive. Like a GBU-12 in there feels like it, you know, there's not room to, you can't barely do a walk around and like check all the stuff you're supposed to check.
You actually check?
Yeah, I definitely check. There's some stuff that like I can open the checklist and like look at stuff. So I definitely check that. As far as my actual walk around, especially in the F-35, it's like, I got nothing for you. Like, it looks like an F-35. Like, yeah, there's almost nothing to look at. Yeah, it's got wings. I do squeeze the I probably shouldn't do that, but the nozzle, I'm like, yep, that's, you know, it moves a little bit, so yeah. Good for it. And then I just jump in it. But yeah, it's a, I don't know, there is goodness obviously to the F-35. It is, especially now that I've, you know, talking to the guys who flew it early that had to deal with some like the G limits and the descent, like they could only descend at a certain like foot per minute, all that stuff, like what a nightmare. But now it's pretty, you know, it's been through all those paces, so it's pretty full up. You can be like me and do what you want in it. It seems to handle it okay. What I don't do is red ball. I don't red ball, and I don't code to this airplane, because they just tell you to turn it off and turn it back on, and I don't got time for that. So I'm like, somebody else is going to turn it back on, and then it will just be a red ball if it's a code to. So we'll figure it out later. Don't tell anybody I said that. We might want to edit that part out.
Yeah, yeah, we'll definitely edit that out. We a robust editing studio, so it should be fine.
F-35 was a product of concurrency, right? Block 60, we did the same thing. And we started rolling aircraft off the line quicker, as soon as they were built, while we were developing the airplane. So the early block airplanes were not really impressive, with lots of restrictions. And the example, the contrast would be Raptor. Raptor, which had everything done, all these years of pain at Edwards and into OT before they finally started producing the airplanes. And at some point, you know, it gets canceled and there's 189 or whatever built, you know, stop short. Where in F-35, there's some pretty clairvoyant people running the show way back when, who said, we want these jets off the line as soon as possible. And oh, by the way, we want them built in 46 of 50 states. So there's a lot of support from congressmen in to keep this thing going, right? And that engineering mindset of, we want everybody involved, we're not going to let this thing get canceled, and we want airplanes off the line as quick as possible. There's some positive elements of that. The Marine Corps got their airplanes, and immediately, so Chip Burke had been a Hornet guy, had been an aggressor. He did F-22 OT as a Marine, and then he was a squadron commander at Eglin when they first got their jets. And he basically took them all in the vault. They threw away all their Harrier and Hornet manuals and started learning from Raptor. And the way they learned to employ F-35 in the beginning, the B model, the Marines are treat it like a Raptor. We're going to start thinking fifth gen right from the beginning. We're not just going to migrate from our fourth gen platforms. And so those guys got way ahead of the maturity of the jet, just developing tactics and starting to think about how you'd manage the airplanes. If you look at some of the partner nations that got airplanes early, like Australia, so they got early lot airplanes, but they got to see fifth gen early in an Air Force that had only had Super Hornets, Legacy Hornets, and, oh, by the way back when, F-111s. And they got to think fifth gen long before or way ahead of the game. And when the mature Jets showed up, well, they had a cadre that knew what the heck they were talking about, and they knew how they trained to this and how to mature guys and how to mature the product and how to integrate it with the rest of the military. And in their case, they have Wedgedale. You know, how are you going to fit with Wedgedale? And how are we going to use our growlers? And so there was an advantage to concurrency to allow the operators to get hands on the platform early. Now, there's a problem of having those early lot airplanes around now. You might as well send them to Nellis and be aggressor airplanes because they're not going to be at Hill. But that early look, I think, paid off for a lot of the forces. Not everybody had the luxury of the U.S. Air Force with Raptors and fifth-gen brains, you know, to just migrate them into F-35. They had to start from scratch, and they did a bunch of learning along the way. If you go talk to the Dutch, they're pretty full up right now, and they were early players in F-35, and I'm sure they appreciated the early look at the airplanes. And that's what concurrency brought. Just to throw that out there.
Oh, that's good.
Can I, before we leave, I'll give you one more thing to Bender, because you're with the Snakes. In my day as a Hornet guy, I spent a lot of time at Hill. My squadron stealing stuff from the bar there, drinking bad bourbon with the squadron commanders of the day, and them stealing stuff from my squadron when they came up to Cold Lake, Alberta. Because I had a really young squadron. I had great majors, but really young, talented captains that had no SA. And the amazing Viper dudes back in the day of Brillo, Mike Brill and all those guys, would come up and be amazing mentors and IPs teaching BFM and full on ACM and teaching our guys and letting them grow with really masterful fighter pilots as their mentors. And in all of that, there was significant stealing of paraphernalia back and forth. And I'm leading to a story because after I retired at Lockheed, I got a call from, so everyone that doesn't know, Mike Brill at the time, the high time, Viper guy for a long, long time, at a mainstay at Hill forever and ever, like hardcore fighter pilot. On my change of command and my retirement at Cold Lake, they came up and stole this one-of-a-kind crest of my squadron that was a stained glass window like you would see in a church. And they stole it and took it back on the KC-135 that had been up there. And it had been in the squadron or at Mike Brill's house, at Brill's house for 20 years since I left. And he called me up and said, like, okay, dude, I'm not part of your squadron and your stained glass window of your squadron, you know, your crest is getting in the way and you need to come get it. So a couple of years, I flew out to Hill and drank some beers because these guys were the most astonishing Viper guys in the day. Like an amazing squadron that everybody wanted to be like and be part of. And I hand carried this huge stained glass window of my crest back through American Airlines flights to Hill to DFW, DFW to Washington, and then packed it, made sure it didn't break in the car ride back to my home at PAX, because it had been liberated by those guys way back when, and they just wanted to make sure I got it back in one piece. Now, I have great affection for your unit.
Yeah, it's a good unit now, and it does have a reputation, especially like the old Viper days that it was just a raging unit. I'm glad you found it because there was a storeroom full of old paraphernalia that we just pretty much chucked like 2 weeks ago. I was afraid we were going to go into the, hey, can you go look and see if you can find it? So happy ending. That's awesome. Yeah, it's a great squadron. I joke all the time in the squadron, but nobody laughs because I think it's true. But I'm like, somehow I snuck in the interview board where it just wasn't very competitive and I got it. Phew. But it's still a pretty high bar to get into the Snakes, which is, it's awesome. I mean, every single dude in that squadron is just full up. Good person, lots of experience, great attitude. So I'm lucky and happy to be there for sure.
Yeah.
Love it. Well, you guys got anything else or should we wrap this one up?
I'm good. Thanks, Rain.
Yeah.
Gents, Billy, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's awesome to meet you, Billy. It's
full up. Thanks for having me, guys. You're more than entertaining listening to, so keep it up. It's comic relief every time I listen to you guys. So thanks
for
having
me. I'm going to throw an untruth into every bro chat from now on about the F-35 just to see how quickly you can respond to Rain.
She's like, you guys are so dumb. Stop saying them. Stop using words.
Stop it.
That's fair. Awesome. See you guys.
See you.
Thanks so much for having me.